Hello, fellow Rebel Capitals. Hope you're well. I'm here with the one and only Jeff Snyder, king of the Euro dollar. Jeff, welcome back, my friend.
Hey, George. How are you?
There's a lot to talk about.
Yeah, there's always lots to talk about.
Let's first focus on the yield curve, because the narrative now is that the yield curve is dead. It's been proven wrong. And then people will give all these reasons as to why it doesn't matter anymore. So let me play devil's advocate here, or give you some pushback. And one of the theories that I heard recently, so much at the front end, she's kind of depriving the issuance at the long end. And therefore, that's what is inverting the curve. And if you just had a normal percentage of distribution, then the curve never would have inverted.
What? Where did this come from?
I'll give you the. I could pull it up on Rebel Capitalist.
No, that's okay.
I don't want to throw the guy under the bus, because I know he's a nice guy.
It's one of those that, hey, we need to reverse engineer something here to make that sounds plausible, because otherwise. I think what it is people start with two things. One, the yield curve inverted, and that means recession. And two, the U.S. doesn't seem to be anywhere close to recession, hasn't for so many years. The yield curve must be wrong. So therefore, we have to explain why those two things are simultaneously
and
true.
Reflation, Jeff, and oil prices and copper prices and gold prices, and the CPI is running hot and the unemployment rate is low. These are all the things that every single viewer has been hearing in the mainstream media.
And it's absolutely true. Except that, okay, let's back up with the Treasury thing. So again, we have to come up with a reason why, if the U.S. economy in particular is incredibly strong, then why did the yield curve invert? And I think that's sent a lot of people to think, okay, what, it must be wrong. There must be something else. There's something else going on with the yield curve to explain the inversion. And first of all, Treasury supply, why anybody thinks that Treasury supply is a factor here is beyond me. I mean, I understand the argument, and it seems like there's an intuitive argument there, because the supply has been absolutely insane, especially recently. But the Treasury market time and time and time again defies all of those expectations. You look at Treasury yields, even now, after the sell-off of the last week or so, yields have basically gone nowhere for the last couple of years.
Which yields are you talking about, Jeff? You talking about the 10-year specifically?
No, I'm talking about the entire yield curve. The yield curve is remarkably stable for a multi-year period. It really hasn't changed all that much. Yes, there are short-run fluctuations back and forth, but it's like this. It's almost perfectly sideways for a long period of time. And in between, we've had how many? It's almost $1.2 trillion in net issuance by the government. So supply is not a major factor in setting prices.
I want to be very, very clear, Jeff. We've had, since 2019, the U.S. debt has gone up by $12 trillion. So we've had $12 trillion worth of issuance in the last, 4 years?
And what's even more remarkable, George, and you know this, is the fact that why are rates at 4.5% instead of like 5.5% or 6%? Because you also have to factor in the Fed's rate hikes. So the short end of the curve has been pushed up by 525 basis points by the Fed. In the long end, in addition to all of the supply, is less than the Fed's short-term rate. That's the inversion.
But that's their argument. So their argument is that all the issuance, not all the $12 trillion, but the majority of the $12 trillion is at the front end. And therefore, since there's no issuance, let's just take it to an extreme, at the long end, and you have demand being relatively the same because their argument, I think, is all these pension funds and XYZ entity in the financial economy, they literally have to buy 10-year treasuries. So the fact that you've got this built-in demand, even when the issuance, you know, the overall issuance is huge, but there's almost zero issuance, taking it to an extreme at the long end, and that's why you get that supply-demand imbalance that creates the inversion.
Yeah, no, I understand the argument. I think it's working backwards from a predetermined conclusion and trying to find a reason for what is really a fundamental issue here. Because even if that was true, it still doesn't put the 10-year treasury at, say, 4.5%, because pension funds and insurance, I mean, regulations don't require institutions to buy specifically the 10-year. They're not going to blindly buy something just because the government told them to. That's not really what happens. So they're not just buying long-term paper because they have to buy long-term paper because somebody said they had to. No. Essentially, they would be buying short-term paper. They have all sorts of strategies that incorporate changes in the yield curve. In fact, they're very sophisticated investors in that regard. They're not simpletons following a very simple set of rules that they have to buy in that bucket. So like I said, you know, supply is not a factor in what is really a fundamental issue, the fundamental marketplace of growth and inflation expectations. And even though the federal government has issued a ton of debt at the front end, even that has only followed along with the Federal Reserve's rate hikes. Treasury bill yields haven't skyrocketed. Short-term interest rates, the two-year, which is incredibly sensitive, is still inverted too. So why hasn't that one exploded much higher if this argument had any validity whatsoever? The two-year would be well above short-term rates, not well below it. So it just, I think that, again, we start out with the idea, that may not be correct idea. The one idea is okay, we know the yield curve inverted a long time ago, and it didn't seem to lead to recession. So what is the other explanation for the yield curve? But we're assuming that second part is true. Because nothing more than time. And it's understandable why people would say, okay, you've been talking about recession for 2 years. Where the hell is it? If it hasn't happened yet, it's not going to happen. So we need to start looking for alternate explanation of what the hell's going on in the yield curve. I mean, Joseph Yang called it dumb money. He said the bond market was dumb money, just doing stupid things. So I think that's what's driving a lot of it. And then you add to it what you were just talking about, George, this reflation stuff. Oh, now we've got reflation on top of everything else, which seems consistent with interest rates rising.
And it's not just a CPI number or a surprisingly high. It's hot. I love how they use that word. Oh my gosh, the CPI print was hot this time, yet 3.4%.
It wasn't hot. That's the thing. The monthly rate was actually less in March than it was in February. And what the argument really is that essentially the CPI has gotten stuck. It's no longer hot. It's just not cooling off.
Right.
So the goalposts get moved every time. Last year, we went through this reflation stuff. It was, the rate of disinflation is slowing down. It's still happening, but it's slowing down. So that must mean that we're in a permanent period of inflation. And now it was, okay, now the disinflation slowed down a lot. Now it stopped slowing down. So maybe it's not going to, it's stuck here at 3% structural rate. And it's no longer about a hot CPI. It's just, it's not cooling off like we want it to. So that's now inflation. But the more important stuff is the reflationary aspects of some of these other markets, because you look at them and think, okay, whatever the CPI, whatever the macroeconomic data, how do we explain copper? Copper, for example. Copper is a pretty good example. Copper is a fundamental commodity that we all look to for economic circumstances and think, if copper's going up, that means that most of the time it means demand. Look at in the middle 2000s, look at some points in the 2010s, some few occasions in the 2010s. Copper prices go up, that's a reflationary signal, isn't it? Well, no, not always. And in the current last couple months, really, copper demand or demand for final copper products after it's been smelted and really refined has plummeted, which has left many Chinese producers to cut back on production. In fact, I was just reading a report from, I forget the outlet, forgive me, where they actually use satellites to track the amount of smelting activity in copper smelters and other metals too. And they've said that the amount of copper production and smelting capacity that's been brought offline in the last just really 6-7 weeks, especially in China, has been enormous. It's almost 20% now, looking to be more. And the reason it's 20% is that these smelters can't get copper from global supply. Global supply is really tight, which means that combined with a fall in end user demand and an overproduction and a glut in end user demand, you've got higher raw material prices and deflation in the end user demand. That's why they're shutting down copper production. But as they're doing that, copper prices continue to go high because people are still using the metal, at least for the next little while. So the point is that copper prices, the raw material that we all follow, Dr. Copper, is being pushed up by supply restrictions, and it's independent of demand, a demand which has fallen off pretty sharply.
Right.
So copper is not signaling a reflation trade. It's signaling the idiosyncrasies of places like Peru, how we can't get the same amount of predictable and steady supply that we normally do. So it's and you can tick them off one after another. So if copper, oil is the other big one, right? Because oil is inflationary, oil is reflationary. But how much of oil prices recently are geopolitics, and how much of that is actual rising demand? When you look at the statistics, China's demand has been down since the middle of last year, and it doesn't look like it's rebounding. It was up a little bit in March. I'm talking about imports compared to January and February, but not really all that much. And you look at U.S. demand. The Energy Information Administration puts out demand, product supply, petroleum supply to the domestic economy. And that is not incredibly weak, but it's much weaker than you would think, given where oil prices are. So time and again, we look at the statistics. They tell us that demand hasn't really changed all that much. It's still really weak. I mean, after all, why do you think OPEC has been cutting supplies? They know demand is weak. And so you add a geopolitical premium. Now you're confusing that geopolitical premium and supply constraint for reflation. And you add that one to copper, and it becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy, right? We know the economy is reflationary because copper prices and oil prices are up. And we know oil prices and copper prices are up because of demand, because we're considering it a reflationary signal. And when you start pulling these apart one after another, you see that that's not the case. Because there's a whole lot that's missing if this was a legitimately reflationary case. Not just demand in those certain commodities. Where's the dollar? Why isn't the dollar falling? Because that is if not the most reliable signal, it is the preeminent signal for reflationary conditions. The dollar should be going down decisively. Now, it's not screaming higher by any means, but it's actually moving slightly higher. Mm-hmm. So the dollar is one that says this is not a reflationary period. And that's just where it starts. We just talked about interest rates. Interest rates are reflecting politics, non-economics of what is Jay Powell and the FOMC going to do in response to oil prices and CPIs. It's not about is the actual economy reflationary. It's the short-term path of interest rates looks to be somewhat higher because we don't know when the rate cuts are actually going to start. When you remove that restriction like we did in December or leading up to December, when the Fed said we're going to get out of the way, start cutting rates, what happened to interest rates? They went shooting lower. So the market wants to go lower in terms of interest rates. It just doesn't know when the Fed is going to get lined up in the same way. And so you go through the reflation stuff one after another, and there's really not as much there as you would think.
When you were talking about the dollar going up while commodity prices are going up as well, the first thing that comes to my mind is like a Milton Friedman type of monetarist view. And when we're talking, and let me unpack that. When we're talking about the dollar, this is created by the banking system. So the fact that the dollar is going up would lead you to believe that the banks are creating fewer dollars, or they're creating fewer loans. The overall credit in the system is decreasing because banks are taking less and less risk. So if you've got the banks, let's say, de-risking, you've got the dollar, and the dollar is telling us that this is what's happening behind the scenes. When you combine that with prices going up on commodities, not as a result of demand, but as a result of supply, at a certain point, the rubber meets the road, right? And then the increase in commodity prices goes from being inflationary to actually deflationary. So, A, have I got that right? And if I do, can you expand on that?
Yeah, I think that's what the dollar's actually saying, really. Because you look at where, it's just for example, DXY. Everybody likes DXY because it's the D dollar index, which is really just a proxy for the euro, but that doesn't matter. It's good enough. DXY started to rise really around July last year, which is right around when oil prices started to become an issue again. That's when the supply shock, or the most recent supply shock, started to really get going, late July into August and September. So might the dollar be going higher because the banking system is becoming more risk averse, knowing what the bigger scale, longer run consequences of repeated oil price shocks are going to be in the real economy? That seems to be a pretty good argument, especially since you don't really see the other side of that in any meaningful or any real visible way. It's a meaningful way, but we just can't see it, right? If we're paying more for oil and certain commodities, gasoline, really, that's what most people pay for. There's no price that tracks all the prices of everything else that goes down in between. Maybe you have CPIs, right, for example, but CPIs get drowned out by oil. So we're looking at inflation through the lens of oil prices that look reflationary, when there's all this other stuff that's hidden that is actually disinflationary and eventually deflationary. So that's why the dollar, George, as you're pointing out here, as you're really moving toward, that's why the dollar is a critical signal. If the dollar was moving decisively lower, like it had in, for example, 2017, 2017 was a really good example of a reflationary period, a legitimately reflationary period. We had globally synchronized, well, it wasn't quite growth, but globally synchronized, no longer a downturn, let's call it that. So you had an uptick in the a real uptick in the economy. So you had commodity prices that were going up. We didn't have all these supply issues that we see today. So it was legitimately, you know, oil prices were rising on demand. Copper prices were going up a little bit on based on demand, that kind of thing. At the same time, you had the dollar going lower. You had better economic numbers in more places around the world. That was a globally synchronized part of it. So it was a legitimately reflationary period. You could actually make the case that late 2022 and early 2023 was reflationary too, because you saw the dollar make a decisive move lower from September of 2022 into the early part of 2023, which was consistent with the idea that Europe had escaped the energy crisis, that the worst case scenarios that were associated with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, those were not going to play out. At the same time, you had China reopening. That was going to provide a huge boost. So there was more of an argument for reflation in 2022 and 2023, late 2022, early 2023, there is today. And as we know, 2023 did not turn out to be reflationary whatsoever. So that was more, there was more to it in that period than there is today. And the reason is because what you just said, at the time, some of that stuff looked reflationary, but eventually the downside of paying more for basically everything, not just oil prices or energy, the supply shock itself, you know, how much purchasing power got destroyed in 2021 and in the early part of 2022, eventually you got to pay for that. And you pay for it in lost demand potential, really economic potential, which is what everything was really telling us when you put it all together.
Unless the money supply was going up, then the inflation would be sustainable. But then we would see the dollar going down. That's the real point I'm trying to highlight for people, that if you've got the money supply like this, regardless of what oil prices are doing, you're robbing Peter to pay Paul. And therefore, you could have a burst of inflation, but that will lead to disinflation, deflation. But if the money supply is going up at, let's just say, the same rate, then you can have that spiral like we saw in the 1970s, where prices continue to go higher and higher and higher and higher. But that's almost impossible unless you've got the money supply going up. And that goes back to the banks. And the fact that the dollar isn't going down tells us that the banks aren't increasing the money supply to lead to that inflationary trend, let's say.
Yeah, and they don't even have to contract credit or money, right? It just needs to grow at a rate that's below what would be required to sustain the current economic circumstances, whether it be okay. Inflation or not. So you can have money supply growth, just a generic term for money supply growth of, say, 2%, but it requires 7% to maintain both economic expansion as well as price expansion. Okay. So if you're growing at 2% instead of 7%, you're going to end up with the same situation. But it might actually take a little bit longer to get there because there's not such a big difference between money supply growth and money demand growth. So that's one reason why maybe the economic cycle has been elongated more than maybe we've been expecting. And I also argue that, you know, with money figures and money totals, what we're really thinking about is not just the dollar. You know, like you said, it's risk aversion and looking for signals that tell us that, you know, that money supply growth, credit growth overall are not going to keep up with the current circumstances. And, you know, the dollar is one of those signals. But in some cases, you don't even need to look at some financial prices and things like that. You just go to the Federal Reserve's H8 statistics and look at bank credit or bank loans. Right. Bank loans and bank credit were expanding in 2020 and 2021. And then late in 2021, it's been flat ever since. So banks have not been expanding their balance sheet, which we could use as a very rough proxy for money supply as a generic term. So you don't even need the U.S. dollar. That alone tells us that, okay, banks are not going to be expanding the system enough to keep up with this forever rising consumer prices, right, as well as expansion.
Let's back up a little bit, because we're talking about the supply-demand dynamics with commodities, which intuitively makes sense. But prior to that, we were talking about how the supply side of the equation with treasuries doesn't matter. So that seems like a logical inconsistency. So how would you explain how the dynamics are different with the treasury market than, say, the commodities market?
I don't think that's inconsistent at all. It's because we're talking about two different kinds of demand. In the commodity markets, it's demand for a physical commodity to undertake a specific task in the real world. Demand for a U.S. Treasury has nothing to do with the amount of supply being issued by the government. It's about, do I want to own safe and liquid investments? That's the fundamental demand. That fundamental demand is independent of the Treasury's issuance of debt securities. Where it comes in is if there was not that same fundamental demand for safe haven status and liquidity status, then it would cause an issue. But we haven't seen that. In fact, what ends up happening is that as the government supplies more debt that the system wants, we get locked into the spiral where we have demand. The demand continues to keep up at a rate that's just, it's just constant. It's almost constant.
It's almost like the more the debt increases, the more growth and inflation expectations go down.
They have to.
Therefore, the more the demand for those treasuries goes up. It's paradox.
It's perverse. It's not what we would like to see, but it's the way it's worked out for the last 15 years. Every time we think that the U.S. government's going to go too far, we end up finding that the reflation we thought was happening was actually a false dawn, which leads to more demand for safety and liquidity. At the same time, the government's only too happy to supply it, which as the government supplies more safety and liquidity, that means because they're doing more in the real economy. And as we know, the more the government does in the real economy, the more likely that's going to reduce growth potential in the real economy, leading to the same self-reinforcing vicious cycle. And we just go through these every once in a while. In the last couple of years have been one of the biggest ones we've ever seen. And we haven't really seen yet the downside to so much government intervention, which are really just massive distortions in the economy. I know the Keynesian argument is, well, that's the pump priming. That just kickstarts the virtuous circle of the virtuous cycle of recovery. But then we have all of these recessions around the world. We have these disinflationary conditions. We have a lot of markets telling us that no, that's not what we're seeing here. We're seeing a prolonged adjustment period to those distortions from a couple years ago. And that adjustment means that eventually we have to find a stable equilibrium. And that's what we're really trying to, that's really the question we're trying to ask here, or the question we're trying to answer is, where is that stable equilibrium? The reflation trade says that the stable equilibrium is right where we are now. We're an economy in the United States that slowed down a little bit, but now we seem to have reached that kind of parity and everything's fine. Whereas around the rest of the world, it's slowed down a little bit more, but maybe things are turning around and we found that equilibrium. That's the underlying thesis of the reflation idea. And then, of course, the trade comes off of it, which is, okay, we've had our adjustment period. Now the adjustment's done and we're ready to move forward.
Okay, so I was just in Argentina for this. I think, well, you know, we talked to you down there when we were hanging out with when Josh and I were driving. But I think one of the main questions that just people watching this live stream have, and it makes sense, is, okay, Jeff, why are Argentinian bonds not safety and liquidity? Why did that, you know, why did they have this debt doom loop spiral that has led to hyperinflation and interest rates being whatever they are, 100% or something like that? Because when the average person looks at what the United States is doing, they say, well, wait a minute here. This is basically what Argentina has done. So why should we expect any different results? And if what Jeff is saying is true, then the interest rate on the Argentinian 10-year bond would be at 4.5%, and all of their government's spending would have led to deflation, and we would have seen Japan. So what's the difference there? Because at surface level, it looks identical.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure it does. I think at a very, very, very high level looking down, there are some similarities. Just when you look at, say, budget deficits and government's propensity to spend way beyond its means. Yeah,
And then the central bank increasing their balance sheet to buy the debt. And, you know, for the average person, it looks
superficially. Again,
yeah, it looks the exact same.
Well, it superficially looks the same, but it's actually superficial. It's not actually the same circumstances whatsoever.
So what makes it different?
The key difference is, number one, the Argentinian government bond market is nowhere near as developed and as not as developed, doesn't have the track record, doesn't have the tradition, it doesn't have the depth, it doesn't have the structure that the treasury market does. And that's one very important
distinction
aspect of the system is that you have to have that level of reliable liquidity in order to become like a treasury. You have to have a dependable history where the Argentinian government has defaulted, it has devalued, has done a number of things that have really threatened the idea of safety as well as liquidity for those bonds. But more than that, there's no external demand for Argentinian government bonds. It's just simply local debt. Whereas the U.S. Treasury, in many ways, U.S. Treasuries are a functional currency in the U.S. dollar system, the euro dollar system. So there is demand for U.S. Treasuries that far in excess of any local government debt, that not just Argentina, anywhere around the world, because they're not useful as a multinational, international sort of currency, whereas U.S. Treasuries are vital to the operation of the U.S. dollar system. There's almost like a perpetual underpinning of demand for that reason alone. Plus, you have tremendous differences between the U.S. economy and its place in the global marketplace versus a smaller country like Argentina, which makes it more prone to those types of flights. There aren't the same level of same type of structural benefits or structural advantages. There's the word. The structural advantages that, say, the United States and treasury markets have that Argentina doesn't have. So I understand the argument. It's superficially, you look at them and they look the same, but they're night and day difference.
Let me push back again. So if what this boils down to, the main thing this boils down to is external demand for dollars and therefore external demand for United States Treasury. But right now we've got China, India, we've got all these BRICS nations that are doing these deals to where they're agreeing to transact outside of that system. And we know that central banks, global central banks, have been buying a lot more gold and they've been buying a lot fewer treasuries. So, and then plus you've got all these sanctions from the Biden administration and all the other countries looking at Russia saying, well, I could be next. So I need to hold a lot fewer of these treasuries. And then let's move over to this other currency where we don't have this counterparty risk of the United States government. And therefore, you're going to see demand for not only the dollar, but U.S. treasuries continue to go down and down and down, all this external demand, to the point where, maybe not now, but if we fast forward 10 years, then there isn't going to be any external demand for the dollar, just like there's no external demand for the Argentinian peso. But yet the United States government is going to be doing the exact same thing they're doing right now from a standpoint of deficits and quantitative easing, just at a 100 times greater rate. And therefore, aren't we just on the exact same path?
No. We heard this argument 10 years ago. So the people 10 years ago said in 10 years, the U.S. dollar is going to be worthless because everybody's moving to an alternative currency format. And here we are 10 years later. And what has been done to create this alternative currency format? It is in the fever dreams of people who have been talking about dollar doom forever. And they keep saying that China and the BRICS countries are building this parallel system when the BRICS countries themselves are like, what are you talking about? We have no interest in building a parallel currency system. We're simply trying to navigate the circumstance that we find ourselves in. Where it makes sense, we'll engage in bilateral trade, which, by the way, always happens. Even before 2008, there was lots of bilateral trade agreements. But either way, the Chinese, the Russians, nobody wants a Chinese-backed or Russian-backed currency system. And the Chinese know it, which is why they're not actually building one. So the fundamental proposition here is that in order for all of that stuff to happen, you have to have and you have to be working toward a legitimate alternative to the current system. We can bitch and moan as much as we want about the current system, and there's plenty of reasons to do that. But nobody is making a serious run at creating a different currency system, least of all the Chinese or the Indians. Now, the Indians are trying to internationalize more the rupee, but not as a challenge to the U.S. dollar, but just to put themselves, to give themselves a seat at the international table. They're not trying to replace the euro dollar system because they realize they can't. Same with China. Everybody knows, and we've been reminded repeatedly this year in particular, a Chinese-backed system would be a complete nightmare. You think it's bad with the Biden administration threatening sanctions against Russia? Look what the Chinese are doing to offshore creditors for all of their developers. They're basically giving them the middle finger. Right. They're saying, yeah, we know you have contracts in place. We know you're supposed to own the collateral, but guess what? Screw you. Right. We're going to do it our way anyway. nobody's going to go to a Chinese system because you know that you're always going to be second or third class when it comes to the real stuff that matters, which is rule of law. So you understand why people are upset about the Biden administration and threatening sanctions and to really to confiscate Russian assets. I mean, that's a big step that even they know that's probably a step too far, which is why they haven't done it yet, because they know that's too much. And it's not about the building a currency system. That's more political fallout than it is monetary fallout. But back to your original question here is, in order for all of that stuff to make any sort of difference, there has to be some parallel system ready, open, and able to absorb all of the functions that a reserve currency does. And when people talk about this, it seems like they don't really understand what a reserve currency actually does. Because if they did, they would say, yeah, we're nowhere close to anything. We're not even close to a parallel system. We're nowhere close to anybody working on one. It's not like people are actually doing one right now. They're doing these small scale transactions to try to navigate the current environment and all of the problems that we have with it. So given all of those, you would think that if these were such massive issues that somebody would have done this already. Why is it in the 2020s we have to wait for a parallel Eurodollar system when the Eurodollar has been tremendously awful for a long period of time? What that tells us is that the project of trying to build a reserve currency, especially from scratch, is an enormous undertaking, and that the benefits are maybe not as big as you think. So if you look at it from strictly a standpoint of a cost-benefit analysis, there's a tremendous cost involved because you have to do a number of things and get a number of things in ready, including investing in infrastructure all over the planet. As I say, it's like having to rebuild the internet from scratch, a parallel internet from scratch, including the software, the hardware, the cables, the wires, everything.
And then get people to use it.
Yeah. And then you have to you have that uncertainty at the end of the day where we're going to spend all of this effort and resources in building this parallel system. We don't really know if anyone's going to use it. And you can't really test it out small scale. You can't build a little bit and see if people come on board. It really has to function at the highest possible level from day one. It's a huge undertaking, a huge uncertainty that explains why nobody has done it. So again, this whole issue boils down to reserve currencies require a tremendous amount of effort and in undertaking, and there's just nobody doing it. So therefore, the argument that the U.S. dollar is going to have less demand for it, Treasury is going to have less demand, it just doesn't hold given that circumstance.
Hey, guys, I want to invite each and every one of you to join me May 31st through June 2nd in Orlando for Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the annual conference I do, and this year it's going to be absolutely incredible. We're going to have some of your favorites there as speakers, guys like Jeff Snyder, Mike Green, The Real Estate, Kenny McElroy. We're going to have Robert Barnes. They're talking about freedom and liberty. Even Rich Cooper is going to be there discussing red pill issues. This event is all about giving you the intel, the insider information you need to not only survive 2024, but thrive. The whole reason I created this event was to give you the tools you need to build the future you deserve for yourself and your family. This is an event you are not going to want to miss. So to get more information, go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. You can see a full list of speakers we've had in the past. You can see clips from past events. And most importantly, you can get your tickets. As we get closer to the event, the tickets go up in price. So you're going to want to get those ASAP at rebelcapitalistlive.com. And we will see you in Orlando, May 31st through June 2nd. I think another thing it's hard for people to swallow, let's say, about this argument is it seems like you're saying that the United States dollar is going to be the world reserve currency forever. And that the debt with the United States is indefinitely sustainable. And we know by looking at history that the country with the reserve currency, they always lose it. Time and time again, it's just like a cycle. It always happens. So, you know, this time it's got to be the exact same. We can't say that the United States is going to have this exorbitant privilege for eternity. No one would argue that. And you can't argue that the debt for the United States is somehow sustainable. Because, you know, the more debt you have, the long end of the curve is going to go up. This is going to force the Fed to monetize the debt, which is going to put downward pressure on the dollar. And you get into this doom loop where rates just go up and up and up. Because at a certain point, even though it might be Tina right now, there is no alternative. People aren't going to want to hold those treasuries if they know that the dollar is losing that type of purchasing power within the United States. Because these things always come to an end, Jeff. There's no way that this is just, there's no way that we can take a snapshot of where we are right now, and this is somehow going to remain in perpetuity forever. So how would you respond to this argument?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's not the argument that we're making at all. We're not saying that the U.S. government has carte blanche forever forward, that they've somehow solved economic laws and financial laws in a way that nobody else has solved that before. Because, I mean, look, the idiots that are running things in Washington are the same. They're the same idiots that we've always seen throughout history. Eventually, they get drunk on their own authority and do what politicians do. There's really nothing different as far as that's concerned. What we're saying is that, given the current constraints that we're trying to operate under, that we have to operate, and we have to operate with reality here, that there is no alternative. And as long as there's no alternative and there's no plausible alternative on the horizon, things can remain this way for a prolonged period of time. Like I said, we've heard this argument for the last 15 years, and here we are 15 years later, way beyond what everybody in, say, 2007 thought were the legitimate limits of the ability of the U.S. government to increase its debt. We're way past that. So what I'm saying is that this system has other incentives, and those incentives are to continue to have that system operate because there is no alternative. And the alternative to that is just utter chaos.
Well, what about gold, Jeff? Gold, they're going to dump the treasuries and they're going to buy gold. We can already see the central banks doing this.
How?
So the private sector is going to catch on. The banks are going to start doing this.
How?
Because they don't want to hold these depreciating dollars and therefore the depreciating treasuries.
See, that's the first thing. Number one, depreciation of U.S. dollar. Why do people even bring that up? Because we've just gone through a period where prosperity has been unparalleled. We have an unparalleled prosperity. At the same time, it has spread all over the world, or at least along much of the rest of the world. And during that time, the U.S. dollar, the value of holding a specific dollar has shrunk to what? 98% of its original value. So those two things, the idea that we don't want to hold, well, yeah, you don't hold dollars to hold them. You don't own dollars to hold them. You own dollars to use them. So that's not an argument to scrap the system. But as far as the other argument goes, the gold argument, well, gold makes a better reserve currency. Well, gold makes a better store of value. I'll give you that. But a store of value is not a medium of exchange. In fact,
but what about the
whole
treasury?
Reason we
why
have
won't they,
this,
why won't this they thing. Why won't they sell all the treasuries and buy gold instead?
To do what with them? You can own gold, but then as soon as you need to use it, what are you going to do? Gold is not liquid. Gold is unusable. The Russians found this out in 2022. They had all of this gold that they built up, and then when the crap hit the fan, they tried to dump the gold. They found no takers for it. So what good is it to have all of this metal sitting in the vaults of the Central Bank of Russia? Gold is not usable. And to make gold usable, even at a fraction of what the Eurodollar system does right now, would require too much effort and resources. Mm-hmm. So central banks are using gold only as a reserve asset, knowing that they can probably liquidate some of it if push comes to shove. But if you have to liquidate an asset, it's not a medium. You're finding that you're changing the store of value into a medium of exchange. And gold is not a good medium of exchange. And I say that as a gold proponent. I love the idea of a classical gold standard and the properties that it brings. But the sad truth of the matter is, and we have to live in reality. We can't live in a romanticized ideal. The reality is gold is not a useful medium of exchange. Now, people can try to make it into one, but we are so far away from that, or even further away from that than
a Chinese
reserve currency system.
You're talking about backing the currency with gold.
Yeah, it's theoretically possible, but it would be incredibly difficult, and I don't see anybody actually doing it. It's not like you can just say one day we're going to start using gold. It doesn't work like that. I mean, how are you going to settle trillions of dollars in transactions every day? And I'm not talking about derivatives or financial instruments. I'm talking about just actual real economy transactions. How are you going to settle that using gold?
Yeah, and I want to be very clear for the audience, and I think they know this. I'm I'm just playing devil's advocate here. And I'm trying with 99% of this, I completely agree with you. And I see things in a similar way. In fact, when I was in Argentina, you know, it, as Josh knows very, very well.
The point. I mean,
yeah, I've got this gold coin right here that was almost impossible to sell. And the only takers that we could find were only willing to give us about 50% of spot. And then you've got this, which actually worked extremely well. This is a silver coin. We were able to get something close to spot here, but unfortunately you've got to sell, you know, 10 of these things every single day just to pay for your hotel room. So just because it's, you know, it's so large, but yet the value is so low that although it's liquid, it's still not really usable. And I think what the way I've described it from a standpoint of helping people understand why the system is maybe so entrenched, and I'd like to get your feedback on this, is I look at a supply of currency globally as a pie chart. And I've got this hypothesis where the greater percentage of the currency that is lent into existence, you get this dynamic where the demand actually controls the supply. So it's very hard to get, let's just say, hyperinflation, where if you would replace 100% of the currency units outstanding with currency that was printed, quite literally printed, like pieces of paper, then all of a sudden, if the demand goes down, the supply doesn't change. And therefore, you would have an equilibrium that would make the value of that currency go down. But because this euro-dollar system is, to your point, reserveless and cashless, it's something you say constantly, nonstop, then that implies that the entirety of the euro-dollar system, those dollars were lent into existence. Therefore, if those dollars or those loans get paid off, the amount of dollars goes down. So you can't just, they're not going to pile up in, you know, like these wheelbarrows that we see in Weimar, Germany or something like that. So do you think that makes a difference as far as what percentage of the overall currency outstanding was lent into existence?
Oh, it's a huge, I mean, George, it's a huge thing. You know, I mean, that's why you're asking the question. But yeah, it makes all the difference because when you talk about hyperinflationary periods, what you're talking about is supply becomes completely detached from any sort of demand or economic or financial fundamentals. Governments start printing actually legitimately, physically and literally printing currency for their own purposes that have nothing to do with the real economy. Whereas the banks in the current system are inside the real economy. They're a very big part of it. And yes, they can go too far on occasions like they did in the 1970s. But the very reason why the Eurodollar system proliferated the way it did, because it was a bank-centered system, is that it is always and has to be some degree responsible to fundamental conditions, whether it be right. demand or something else, because it's baked into how banks operate their balance sheets. Like I said, it's not perfect. It's not one-to-one. And there are periods where variations can be wide. But there is no way to completely sever the way banks issue credit from actual underlying demand, or at least what perceptions of demand are. It's not like banks are going to start issuing credit for the sake of issuing credit. They have no reason to do so. And there's no real incentive for them to do so. It's not like a government that just fires up the printing press to make sure they can pay its bills. Banks don't have that kind of setup to do so. So they're always somewhat responsive to the real economy. And so there's going to be some – if demand for money starts to fall off and banks are still supplying it, eventually, like a spring, it'll come back down because there's always that attachment.
Yeah, and then when the people are paying off the loans, if there's on net balance, more loans being paid off, the supply of those currency units goes right back down, just like what you're saying. And that's what – it's very difficult for people to get their head around that because when they think about bank lending, they think that a bank is just taking dollars from over here and lending it out over there, where they need to realize that banks don't lend money. They create money when they lend. And therefore, when the debt is paid off, it destroys the money that was created to begin with.
Yeah, you need to think outside of currency and the way we always think of currency. It's just a number on a computer. So they increase somebody's value when they make a loan, and they keep track of how those numbers transfer throughout the system. It's incredibly elegant and it's incredibly complicated, but it's really no more. It really isn't any. It's really that simple. It's that we're just talking about banks keeping track of who owes what and who owns what.
Okay, so the next pushback we're going to get, Jeff, I can guarantee you, is all right. Well, I understand what you're saying. The pie chart matters, but pretty soon the government. Fed is going to have to do yield curve control. We're going to go into quantitative easing, and this effectively is the Federal Reserve printing all of this money, just like they did in Argentina. It might not be green pieces of paper, but it's basically electronic dollars that are on their balance sheet, the balance sheets of the banks. And therefore, if they're creating all these currency units, printing this money to buy all the treasuries that they have to, well, then that takes us right back to Argentina.
But we've already seen this, right? I mean, we talked about yield curve control in 2022 when interest rates started to go up really fast, well, because the Federal Reserve was pushing them up. Everybody said, okay, we're going to need yield curve control because the U.S. government is issuing tons of debt. And now the Fed is no longer the preeminent buyer of treasuries. The market's going to fall apart. We're going to need the Fed to come back in with some form of YCC to make sure that the interest rates don't get out of control. And then the talk just disappeared because interest rates in October of 2022 stabilized. Surprised the hell out of everybody because they thought, well, without the Fed, there's absolutely no way interest rates, there's no way without that big buyer in the marketplace, there's no way that prices could stabilize. And they did. And we hear this every single time that the government has to come in and stabilize the treasury market because same reasons as before, except that we go through these fluctuations where interest rates go down, they go back up, they go back down again, they go up again. And every time interest rates go up, everybody says, this is the one, this is the sell-off, this is the end of the line for the U.S. Treasury market, so it's going to be yield curve control. So what I'm saying is that people are assuming things that maybe they should never really assume. That they're assuming that the Fed is going to have to come in with a yield curve control to control the Treasury market that's going to get out of control, even though the Treasury market has established this history time and again of not getting out of control. That there is no reason for the Fed to do so. So as far as that's concerned, again, you're just making an assumption that doesn't stand up to historical scrutiny. And then the other part of it is, okay, QE. So let's say we go through another disinflationary, maybe even deflationary period. Maybe the yield curve is actually correct this time, and the U.S. economy is not strong. And that in response to a recession, maybe at the end of this year, maybe a nasty one, not only will the Fed restart QE because even as the Fed has said itself, QE is no longer an extraordinary tool. It is now a regular tool.
Right.
So they don't need to use it at the zero lower bound. They're just going to use it whenever they feel like they need to stimulate the economy. At the same time, we know the federal government is not going to sit on its hands, although there's probably going to be some resistance to doing fiscal stimulus because we've been constantly stimulated by the fiscal side for the last 4 years, really. But either way, the deficits are not going to go down during recession. We know that much. So yeah, there's going to be more Federal Reserve activities, but like the past Federal Reserve activities that haven't produced those results either, you have to look around and ask for and start asking questions. Why? Every time we hear these arguments come out and they don't happen, why didn't they happen? We at least need to answer those questions before we go on to the next cycle and just assume that, well, the next cycle is going to be the one, and then it's going to be the one after that, and then it's going to be the one after that. Without stopping and thinking, why do we not end up with these hyperinflationary, ridiculously inflationary periods because of the Fed printing all of this money and monetizing the debt? Why didn't we have that before? Is there some magical limit? Is it all about a numbers game? It's really about getting down to the fundamental truths here, which is about how money actually works. And it's not, the Fed doesn't print money. The Fed doesn't introduce all of that currency into the real economy. And so it doesn't have those types of impacts. So the Fed can do more QE. The Fed can appear to be monetizing the debt, and it doesn't lead to all of those big time consequences because the Fed isn't actually doing what you're assuming that they.
I think the pushback there would be at the end of 2020, we saw M2 money supply go up by 25%, and that was a result of the Federal Reserve buying assets from non-bank entities. And Jeff, that's what produced the consumer price or the CPI going all the way up to 9.1%. in June or July of 22. So how do you connect those dots? I mean, how are you saying that QE never resulted in consumer prices when we can obviously see that in 2020 and 2021, it did?
Well, the Federal Reserve wasn't the issue there. It's the federal government that was the issue there because the federal government prodded the banking system to increase their balance sheets. And then the federal government decided to redistribute all of that created credit through the real economy, through real economic channels. But as we talked about earlier, that didn't lead to a constant introduction of money and credit growth. Banks did that the one time, and then they're like, that's it. We shut it down. After late 2021, they stopped creating credit. So the federal government came in, basically strong-armed the banking system to buy all these treasuries and whatnot. It wasn't the Federal Reserve, it was the federal government. And then the federal government took that the proceeds of that and threw it into the real economy. That's where the consumer prices came from. And I don't even think if that had been the end of the story, I don't think consumer prices would have gone up by all that much. The real issue with consumer prices was the supply restriction.
Right.
So they introduced all of this excess demand by redistributing currency into the real economy, digital currencies, into the real economy at the same time that supply could not respond to that sudden burst of demand. In simple economics, prices have to be the adjustment factor. And that's what happened. So the federal government came in, boosted demand through this one-time redistribution of credit. Actually, it was three times, but you know what I'm saying. This one period of time where they did this created a level of demand that the global economy just could not meet. And because the global economy couldn't meet it, there's your consumer prices. But now as the global economy has emerged from that supply shock, from all the logistical problems, it has been able to respond to changes in demand. And now you have less and less price changes. You don't have the same, like, we're not back in full disinflation. We're not going to experience deflation. But now that we don't have that supply constraint, I think that explains most of the potential for consumer prices.
Why do you think the prices have remained so sticky if the banks don't want to lend? We see a massive reduction in trend, if not down, when we look at loans and leases and just a flattening out in bank credit. So based on if we're looking at this from a standpoint of a monetarist, you would look at that and you'd say, okay, prices have to be going down, or at least this inflationary trend has got to be continuing. So why is it remaining sticky?
Well, there's two reasons. One is the easy answer, which is oil. Oil prices have, over the last, almost a year here, really since last summer. So we're talking about 8-9 months. Oil prices and two really pretty substantial supply or price shocks. We've seen that has a direct impact on consumer prices. That's not necessarily inflation. It has nothing to do with bank credit or anything else. That's just a supply shock. And then the other side of that, both the supply shock and the question you're asking is, you got to think globally here. We have seen deflation. We have seen economies that have demand destroyed to the point that they are in recession. Europe is a prime example. China is another one. China is thoroughly disinflationary, if not deflationary, too. So we are seeing the downside of it. It just hasn't happened here in the United States. And people in the U.S. tend to look less outside the U.S. than not. And so they're focused entirely on the U.S. economy and thinking that these are all we just have to look at the U.S. We have to look at U.S. credit, U.S. GDP, and U.S. prices and not think about this as a global system that is in many ways interconnected to the point where it is a singular system. It's not the U.S. economy and the European economy and the Chinese economy. It's the Chinese part of the global system. It's the U.S. part of the global system. It's the European part. And the European part and the Chinese part and some of the emerging market parts, they have indeed showed the signs of everything that we're talking about here, mm-hmm. even if we haven't seen them more dramatically and more visibly in the United States.
All right. And then the resiliency, let's say, of the United States itself, that's kind of the big question mark. But even if we see the long end of the curve go up, which it has slightly over the last few weeks or so, the inversion has remained the same, meaning that the 2-year treasury has gone up in pretty much lockstep with the 10-year treasury, which is the signal from the bond market saying future growth and inflation expectations, although they might be slightly higher, are still a lot lower, and we're expecting the Fed to drop rates.
Yeah, that's... The 2-year, 10-year spread being as constant as it is basically telling you that the market is looking at this through the lens of will they cut rates or when will they cut rates? This is all about an adjustment to the Federal Reserve, and they're trying to guess when Fed officials will start cutting rates, because we know they're going to do it. It's just a matter of when. So the fact that the 2-year, 10-year spread hasn't changed, that says that the market has not repriced growth and inflation expectations. It's just repricing the Fed in the start of the rate cuts, which... We go back and forth through this all the time. And so if oil prices suddenly come down, which they're likely to do because oil goes too far and then it destroys demand and it comes back down. So oil prices come down in the next couple of months. What are we going to be talking about as far as CPIs go?
Oh, disinflation,
we're going to be right back in disinflation like we were in November and December and January. We're going to be talking about disinflation again, except this time the Fed's going to say, okay, we're all set. Let's start cutting rates. We all know it's going to happen. We just don't know when. And it's really difficult to get in the heads of politicians and say, okay, what are they thinking that's going to lead to? What are they thinking about the next month's CPI or the CPI after that? But the real bigger question was the other part, the resilient U.S. economy. And I think that's part of the adjustment process of these massive distortions over the last couple of years. And one of the biggest massive distortions was the just like we talked about before, the supply inelasticity in terms of labor. So that not only did it increase the price of labor, though not enough to compensate for consumer prices, there was also a dramatic response to that from businesses themselves. They have proven time and again that they're going to hoard workers, no matter what the circumstances are. And so they are not laying off workers in the same way that they would. They probably would have, especially last year, early part of last year, if we were in a more traditional cycle. And so that appears to be economic strength when it's actually corporate managers saying, we'll take the hit to profits a little bit here and just maintain our workforce. Even if we don't have enough work for them to do, it's better for us to hold on to them, just waiting for that recovery, that reflation, everything that we're all waiting for. So the resilient U.S. economy may not be resilient so much as just the idiosyncrasies of the last several years and the really unpredictable ways that this adjustment process can take place and how it actually works out. And that's just there's others that we have to factor too, including the nominal economy.
And what about the fiscal? I was going to go to the fiscal because that's another argument there.
That's another one too.
Fiscal is so high, that's what's keeping the economy afloat, and that's what's increasing the aggregate demand to a level where we're going to continue to see nominal GDP at 4%, 5%, 6%.
I don't know about that, but you could say that the fiscal approach in 2023 was the reason that GDP wasn't, say, 1% rather than, 2.5% or almost 3%.
Yeah, and then what they're going to say is that fiscal is just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger as we go from year to year to year. It's never going to shrink, and therefore can't that continue to prop up this economy to where you're not going to get that disinflation or outright deflation?
Well, I think the fiscal could be constant at those levels, but the economy, the private sector underneath is slowing down, and eventually it starts to contract. And so while the fiscal side makes it look better than it actually is, it doesn't do anything to prevent the private economy from going where it's going. And where I was going is that we do see signs of the private economy actually having to do something like that. I mean, I've talked about this till I'm blue in the face. Everybody wants to look at the payroll report and the tremendous payroll number. You look at the rest of the labor data, whatever you think about layoffs, businesses are already cutting back. There is definitely a hiring freeze, and they're definitely cutting workers an hour, or not workers, they're cutting workers' hours. So that, full-time to part-time conversions, that's taking place. We've got all sorts of evidence that suggests, as I'm saying, that these businesses are making very big adjustments, very substantial adjustments to their costs because they're seeing the downturn in the nominal private economy that is causing these to happen. Whether or not we see it in GDP, maybe the fiscal side is covering up the degree to which it's already happened, and maybe it's making people's expectations of the future a little bit more optimistic than it otherwise would have been. But you can look at this and say, there is a consistent picture behind everything. And it all goes back to 2020 and 2021, the huge distortions that we were working with. And so back to our original question, maybe that's all the yield curve was saying, is that, look, we know that there's going to be an adjustment here, and maybe it'll take forever. Maybe it won't take. We don't know. We don't have any idea how long it's going to take. But eventually this thing works out. This adjustment period works out the same way it always does. What's variable here is the length of time and the angle at which the adjustment takes place. So far, it's been really shallow, the downturn in the sectors that have been turning lower, but it's still the same thing. And what has changed is only that people have lost patience with that explanation, that idea. People have said, okay, we've been talking about this too long. It hasn't happened. Therefore, it's not happening. When you actually look around at everything, all the evidence, look around the rest of the world, look around in the marketplace, including the commodities that we talked about, the supply factors. What they're really saying is that we're still in that adjustment process. It hasn't ended. It hasn't gotten to its conclusion. The economy has not reached a stable equilibrium. It's just taking forever to get there.
Can you use the delta between the 2-year and the 10-year as a timing? And what I mean by that is if we were, let's say the delta right now is 50 basis points. If we start to see that go down to 30, 2010 as a result of a bull steepener, and then we see that uninversion. Could that give you kind of a signal as to the timing as to when we might see a recession? In other words, the closer we get to an uninversion due to a bull steepener, the higher the probability that we do see the unemployment rate start to go up and something like NBER actually admitting that we are in a recession.
Yeah, that is the one timing mechanism. And it's not a foolproof one either.
Yeah.
I think we talked about this a couple months ago when the 2-year was looking like it was going to start going below the 10-year back in January, I think. What I said was, look, it's got to go through. We got to have an uninversion, and then it's got to stick. It can't just be a little bit of an uninversion, then it goes away, because that's what normally happens. In fact, we never got the uninversion, and then it went away. So we need to see the market do that. We need to see the 2-year go below the 10-year and then have it stick that way for somewhat of a period of time, and then make a decisive move to a steepening. And that just, it didn't happen to this point. But yes, that is the one part of the yield curve where you can say, okay, now the market is reasonably certain. Before, it's all been conjecture. Before, it's all been mild probabilities. But if we have the bull steepener case where the 2-year goes below the 10-year, then it's no longer just maybe it might happen. It's okay. Now it is actually seeming to happen. We see that throughout history before recessions, like right before recessions, where you see the 2-year, 10-year uninvert in the other direction, the downward direction.
Yeah, and that's usually a result of the Fed dropping rates, isn't it?
Well, it's the market saying that, well, first of all, flight to safety, and it doesn't hurt that the Federal Reserve is going to get out of the way by not holding rates higher and essentially say, oh, yeah, we see the same thing.
That's a better way to say it.
And so we're going to cut rates as well.
Yeah. So in other words, the Fed's following the market is what you're saying.
Yeah,
let's not give the Fed too much credit.
Well, that's what we're struggling with here. The market is trying to say, you know, like I said before, trying to figure out what happens when the Fed gets out of the way. Well, when the Fed says we're going to get out of the way, rates go down. They want to go down, so they go lower. And then the Fed says, no, we're not going to get out of the way. And so rates have to come back up a bit because we have to figure out what the Fed's going to do. But once it gets to the point where the market is absolutely certain there's enough there, then rates will go down regardless of what the Fed says, because the Fed always says we're not cutting rates right up until the moment it does. That's what's so unusual. Another thing that's so unusual about this current cycle is the Fed actually says we're going to cut rates. We know we're going to do it. We just think they're benign reasons. But, you know, it's this really weird, unique period in history where you can't look back at the past and say there's a really easy template that we can follow, whether it be financial stuff, whether it be economic stuff or anything else. We're really kind of flying blind here and trying to adapt the tools that we have to these unique circumstances.
And I think you'd agree that when we can actually claim that the yield curve is wrong this time is when we have an uninversion as a result of a bear steepener that is sustained for, let's just say, 6 months or something like that. Then we step back and say, okay, yes, it is true. The yield curve was incorrect. And then we go through the process of trying to figure out why it was incorrect.
And then we would need all sorts of confirmation, because you never rely on one signal. You never focus on just one signal. So like we were talking about the reflation stuff, we would need to see legitimate proof or evidence that reflation is actually happening. So if you get the US dollar making a decisive move lower,
at the same time,
the curve is doing a bear steepening.
And
right?
Bank credit going up.
Yeah, so that would be a huge one. If you see some of these other commodities that aren't having supply issues turn around, like steel and iron, which they've come up off their bottom, but steel and iron have crashed recently. Those are highly disinflationary, deflationary signals. If they make a dramatic move higher, and you know, any number of other financial signals that would corroborate moving tips break evens that the break even curve right now is inverted, which means short term break evens are above long runs, which tells you that the market is not thinking about growth and inflation expectations. It's looking at oil as a transitory phenomenon, like it is. And so eventually oil prices come back down. So if tips break even start to steepen out there too, you would see a number of corroborating signals that suggest, okay, the yield curve is making a decisive move. The dollar is making a decisive move. These commodities are making decisive moves, and they're all doing it at the same time and in the same way. Yeah, this time we're getting to a real reflation. And if we didn't have a recession by then yes, the yield curve would have been wrong about all of it.
Jeff, let me play devil's advocate one more time here. What about credit spreads being so tight? How do you reconcile this with corporate spreads? Shouldn't we see them starting to blow out if the yield curve is correct?
Yeah, I think that's part of this unique circumstances that we're in here. Some of that I do believe has to do with liquidity. Some of what's driving some of these corporate spreads, I believe, is demand for liquid assets, because most of those corporate bonds end up in corporate debt ends up in some form of CLO. So there's a tremendous amount of demand for strictly corporate debt versus other forms of debt like commercial real estate. So you have commercial real estate that's sort of, I don't really want to touch that, but I do want some yield. I do want some assets. And you know what? Corporate bonds and corporate debt, let's buy those. So there's demand for corporate debt that may be driven by distaste and disfavor for other parts of the system. So even though, you know, credit spreads on CRE and some of that stuff has been incredibly tame too, we have seen some widening in, say, multifamily parts of the marketplace, but nothing that would make you think that something's really big happening. But I think that's one of the reasons why credit spreads and corporate credit has been incredibly low, is that there's demand for credit. And there's assumption that even if we go through a downturn, it's not going to lead to a tremendous number of bankruptcies, because we've had a lot of bankruptcies over the last couple of years. How many more businesses can go bankrupt, and how much more credit can go bankrupt, and how many more losses and defaults will there actually
be? I would argue, too, it's got to have something to do with the fact that they think that the Fed or the government's going to bail out these corporations anyway, that they're going to bail out.
Part of
it's like
too.
A moral hazard.
Yeah, especially after the corporate credit program that came in 2020.
Yeah, yeah,
not that the Fed bought any government. I mean, they didn't really buy any of the ETFs.
They put an implicit put there, a psychological put. And then if you're a buyer or an investor right now, you think that's going to happen again if the stuff hits the fan. So why not just buy it at a little bit higher yield than the Treasury?
The argument, if you let me play devil's advocate here, the argument against that is that credit spreads did get pretty high in 2022. So there was a bit of a blowout then. So I think a lot of it is driven by some individual factors that have a lot. There's a relationship between Europe and offshore credit and onshore credit. There's some of that's taking place too. And there was a lot more fear over the corporate side of things in 2022 specifically, that some of those things have gone away. So maybe there is some implicit idea the Fed's going to bail us out if we get too much. But I really think it's about corporations and business debt is safe. It's liquid in a CLO form or some kind of leveraged loan or syndicated loan product. Whereas some of the other forms of credit, we'll just move everything in our portfolio over to the corporate side.
Yeah. Okay. And I want to tell the audience that we had no plan whatsoever for us to go back and forth there with kind of like almost a little mock debate. That's just the way that I decided to take the conversation, because I thought it'd be fun. Because I think when people listen to you on Euro Dollar University, on your podcast, on your YouTube channel, these are some of the, as you speak, these are a lot of the questions that they have in the back of their mind that just don't reconcile for them. So hopefully that was a very instructive process for the audience. But you're going to be speaking at Rebel Capitalists Live May 31st through June 2nd. You're going to be there with Mike Green, with Kenny, an incredible group of people. Joseph Wang is also going to be there, so maybe we'll get you guys up on stage going back and forth. But if you were to place a bet as to interest rates being higher or lower by Rebel Capitalists Live, we're talking about the 10-year, what do you think?
I mean, a month away? What is that, a month and a half away? I mean, you got a dartboard? Short run is a complete crapshoot. There's no way to predict the short run. But I would say path of least resistance, rates are probably higher. And that all hinges on what oil does from here. If oil
What about Middle East?
Yeah, so if the Middle East calms down and oil prices start to decline, not just because of that, but also because we do see signs of demand destruction, then all bets are off as far as that goes. I think if the Fed, oil prices go lower, which is probably not enough time for the CPI to come out really tame, although it was pretty tame in March. If there's somehow a way for the April CPI to come out in May, decisively disinflationary, and then Jay Powell says, yeah, you know what, we're going to take this as a definitive signal, interest rates will go way down. But I don't think there's nearly enough time for that to happen. So we're talking about maybe mid-year to summer before we start looking at something like that. And then we're into this August-September effect, which is when rates go up anyway.
Right.
So path of least resistance, I think interest rates still rise from here unless something big happens and really scrambles things up.
Yeah, very good. All right, tell people about your Euro Dollar University. It's literally a podcast that I listen to every morning when I go to the gym. It comes out super early, so thank you for that. And
yeah, it was actually yesterday.
Oh, does it go? Well, okay, guys, that's why it's so early.
You're a day behind.
But tell us about the podcast. Tell us about the YouTube channel, and tell us about your website.
Yeah, Eurodollar University, it's the name of the YouTube channel, as well as the website, which is just eurodollar.university. And yes, we do go over all of these things from the perspective of the Eurodollar system, including what that is, why that is, and why is it such a big part of seemingly everything. There's not really an aspect it doesn't touch. So we go over that stuff daily on YouTube. And then there's much more in-depth information at our website, eurodollar.university. We've got subscriptions and memberships. The memberships are about, what is the Eurodollar? How is it supposed to work? How does it all fit together? What is money? All that kind of stuff. And the subscriptions are about, how do we take and channel all of that information into understanding what the world is looking like today?
Yeah. And Jeff, I know you don't pay any attention to this whatsoever. So I just want to go to the Rebel Capitalist Live homepage so you can see who is actually going to be there as far as speakers. A lot of speakers, you know, they'll go, like last night, I went on New Orleans Investment Conference, their website, to see who was going to be there. You know, see who I could hang out with, maybe grab dinner. But I know that that's not the way you roll. So just for your information, Josh, if you could switch us over here, you're going to be there right now with Mike, with Kenny, like we said, Hartman, Chris McIntosh, Mark Moss, Joseph Wang, Rich Cooper, Robert Barnes, Ivor Cummins. You're probably really going to, I don't know if you know Ivor, but I think he's going to be one of the most popular speakers there for sure. And then VIP guest, Kiyosaki is going to be there. So I'm sure he's going to want to talk to you. Brent's going to be there. Viva Fry, uneducated economist. Tracy is going to be there. Another one of your good friends and business partners. And then of course the VIP of all VIPs, Josh. Mr. Josh Lessard himself.
You guys have buried the headliner. Josh is the headliner.
That's right. That's right. So anyway, you guys can get your tickets at rebelcapitalslive.com. Jeff, thanks for coming on, buddy. We'll talk to you soon.
Always a pleasure, George. Thanks.